Listen and stream the all-new talk radio Freedom 106.5 for the only talk that matter.
Joining us this morning, gentlemen, he's been on the show before when we had a special month celebrity guest. He was here with us. And he joins us again. It's our pleasure to welcome to our program to speak to us on very, very specific things this morning. Minister in the Ministry of Finance, Brian Manning, good morning to you. Welcome back to our program.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. Greatly appreciate it.
Nice to have you with us here this morning. We're here to discuss fiscal matters, that's for sure. But we're having several other discussions, and I just wanted to get your comments on some of those before we head into the nitty-gritty. Yesterday at the CARICOM Forum, numerous speakers highlighted the financial challenges that crime takes on a country's budget. And yes, that increased crime leads to increased expenses when having to treat with the victims and some of the perpetrators who get themselves injured and all of those kinds of things. As a minister in the Ministry of Finance, I'm sure this is an element that the Ministry of Finance is paying close attention to. The Prime Minister highlighted in great detail the finances of it as well. But how big of a problem is it for us when it comes to the increased expenditure for crime and crime-related injuries?
Yeah, so of course, crime is a cost in any society. It increases the cost of doing business for business people. Of course, it increases the cost of any government. You'd have to increase your national security budget. You'd have to increase your health care budget. Business people would have to pay more for security and for other ways to protect themselves from criminals. So, of course, it increases the cost of business. It makes your economy less viable, less, I'd say, efficient, less productive. And it is a serious concern, and it's something that we take very seriously at the Ministry of Finance.
Yeah, I'm sure that it is, because with not as much money as we had to spend around, when you have increased costs like these, it does present an additional challenge.
Especially costs that can be prevented. You know, you try to shave out as many unnecessary costs as possible. So you try to reduce or minimize crime to the best of your ability. And one thing that has come out of those talks today, yesterday and today, is you've seen the explosion in crime post-COVID around the entire region. It's not just here in Trinidad and Tobago. The COVID crisis was extremely traumatic to the people of the world. And I think that there are a lot of people that are still being affected by basically 2 years of isolation. Of course, as a member of parliament for San Fernando East, I was on the front lines of fighting the COVID pandemic and basically helping persons within the constituency. Mm-hmm. And you saw the effects it would have on persons. People were unemployed for 2 years. People were forced to live on top of each other when they may not have had a good relationship, even when they weren't forced to do that. You saw an increase in domestic violence. You saw an increase in evictions. People had difficulty living with each other, being around each other 24 hours a day. And it led to some persons evicting family members in the middle of a pandemic. So you definitely saw the kinds of effects the pandemic had on the economic integrity of persons, and also the emotional and physical health of persons.
Well, I understand that. I do. And I mean, I've been trying to make the world around me a better place, helping people on the program here, listeners, we band together, and we try our best to render assistance where we can. But I don't know if I necessarily buy into the discussion that post-pandemic, that people who weren't working, and because they weren't working, they turned their life a crime. And these home invasions and the increase in crime that we are seeing is as a result.
No, it's not just that.
Right.
It's not just that. It's also the trauma of it all. The trauma has affected people mentally. As I was saying, it's not just a Trinidad and Tobago problem. Mm-hmm. It's a regional problem. We listen to our regional leaders speak. How is it that there's an explosion in crime throughout the region at the same time? It's a similar stressor that was placed on the people of the entire region and the world at the same time. And we have seen the effect of it on persons, not just on their economic health, but their mental and physical health, emotional health. And that's why it's being seen more as a health issue and not just as punishing criminals. You know, it's like a difference in the United States between the crack epidemic and the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. The crack epidemic were seen as criminal activity, and that, and because of that, crack users were treated in a certain manner. They were treated as criminals. Now, with the opioid crisis being viewed as a health issue, now we are looking at these persons as patients, as persons that, that need help, as opposed to just trying to lock everybody up and throw them in prison,
wow,
which would not really make any dent in the crisis, as it did not with the crack crisis.
Well, we spoke about that briefly yesterday with our guest, and she put forward the suggestion that it is not necessarily so much about what is being used, but about who using it, and that the crack users...
So that too.
Crack users.
But the treatment is different.
It is, yeah, definitely.
The treatment is different.
It is definitely, yeah, different, because you had the crack users who were treated one way because people suspected, or the information suggested that was one demographic, and the people who are using the next one is, yes, a different demographic, so we have to find a different way to treat with them.
Yes, they put crack users in prison for decades.
Yeah.
For decades, to no avail. It destroyed families, it destroyed homes, it hurt the American economy, and they made very little dent in the whole problem.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're saying differently that opioid abusers are persons that need help. So the whole approach is different. They're not trying to lock up everybody.
Mm-hmm.
As I heard recently, you know, business people were commenting that they should, some business people, sorry, were commenting that they should empty death row, that they should just kill everyone who has committed serious crime. But now, there are people on death row that definitely belong to be there.
Mm.
But that can't be the solution to our problem. I would ask the same business people, how much have you reinvested in the young people of this country? What have you been doing to give back to the community in which you have been able to run your profitable business?
Yeah.
Because we have to invest in the young people of this country to ensure that they don't get on death row in the first place.
You...
And to me, that is just a more sensible policy. Let's just kill everyone who commit serious crime.
I had some discussions many years ago about the same thing about opium use in some parts of the world. I can't remember the country. And they took a real out-of-the-box approach in that what they did is the government stepped in and they made it free. They started,
yes,
they started administering it the same way you had cannabis, in a very controlled manner. And what they did is they took,
yes,
they took the crime element out of it, because it was no longer lucrative. You couldn't, they're giving it away, so selling it, you couldn't,
yes,
get anybody to buy it. And once they dealt with
it, you were able to treat people and,
yes,
educate them and
yeah,
have them
and
tested and centralized and rehabilitated. Correct?
Yeah, and it worked. I just can't remember where. So that,
I remember reading about it on a small scale, and there have been several proposals, even during the crack era, of doing the same thing. But I don't think too many people were brave enough,
mm-hmm,
too many governments were brave enough to try that policy. So
yeah,
I didn't get too far. But I do remember reading about it.
As MP, you would obviously be monitoring what's going on in your constituency. And the constituency you represent is one that your father has represented for decades prior to you taking it.
Yes.
What's going on in your constituency? Other MPs are expressing their concerns about crime, and I'm sure that you will have concerns.
Yes.
Are you seeing trends that are worrying to you? Is it just par for the course? What's going on?
No, we have had an increase in criminal activity within San Fernando East. We have really been trying to deal with some of the more vulnerable persons within the constituency, trying to create employment opportunities where we can. And the government in general has been trying to deal with those issues.
Mm-hmm.
We are trying to stimulate this economy by focusing on a lot of infrastructural projects, as you would have heard the Minister of Finance and also the Prime Minister state publicly, and also dealing with some of the more social issues within the constituency. We at the San Fernando East constituency have been having our outreach projects. Every month, every quarter, we have our caravan into different parts of the constituency where we give people access to government government services, whether it's LSA for persons who may be squatting, who want to own their own property, the land for the landless, social services. The Ministry of Social Development has been extremely active and helpful in trying to educate persons into what social services are available to them if you are in need. Some of the youth programs, whether it's CCC, YTEP, you know, the whole alphabet soup of youth programs that are available. We are trying to get out there to educate young people, to show them that, look, there are opportunities here, but you have to avail yourselves to them. And then those that are looking for employment, we are trying to increase economic activity within the constituency. We are a very residential constituency.
Okay.
So we are basically through construction, housing, drainage works, road works, and other activity in terms of infrastructural projects.
Have you been seeing the home invasions that the other parts of the country have been seeing as well?
it's not as dramatic as in some other parts of the country, but we have seen an uptick in criminal activity in the constituents.
Let's get to the topic that we brought you here to discuss, and that's the country's economy and our finances and what we're looking at. When the finance minister presented our budget last year, in September, at the beginning of the financial year, he spoke about the life jacket that we received as a result of the volatility between Ukraine and Russia, how that bumped up energy prices, and how we were able to benefit to the point where we realized income that nobody actually thought we would have. In fact, we were predicting a budget deficit at 8 point something, I think it was, billion dollars. And we were able to make more than that, actually. 6 months later...
Our first surplus in about, almost 15 years.
Exactly. But 6 months later, a lot has happened. When it comes to energy prices, when it comes to our output and our production and all those things, a lot has changed. Give us an idea of some of what the country had to grapple with in the past 6 months when it comes to our money.
Yes, well, not just the past 6 months. You can't look at it in such a narrow view. Remember, coming out of the COVID crisis, all of our finances, we would have budgeted funds for different objectives, different projects, and so on. Much of those funds were diverted towards fighting COVID. And the country was shut down for a period of time, so there's not much construction that took place. It's why our roads fell apart at one point in time, because we weren't fixing the roads because the funds were being diverted for other activities. And then we had a very powerful rainy season last season, which also made roadworks quite difficult and other construction. And that's why we've been in such a drive right now to really get a lot of the roadworks and other types of works done before the beginning of the rainy season, and at least before things get serious. Because we understood what happened last year. Farmers were affected by the heavy rainfall, construction, road work, you name it. All those things were affected. That, of course, is going to affect the productivity of your economy. So all of these things we have to keep in mind. And that's why we are really pushing to get as much done as quickly as possible right now. In terms of the HSF, we were fortunate enough to invest a lot of the surplus revenues that we earned early in the year from high commodity prices into the HSF. And that was able to assist us to smooth things later on as things fell. And unfortunately, and surprisingly, recently, OPEC decided to cut supply, which stabilized oil and gas prices to a level which was above our budgeted energy price. Mm. So that was extremely helpful to us. The prices were plummeting at one point, and that was very concerning, of course. But now that they have stabilized, we feel quite, you know, comforted by that. So, you know, we plan. Of course, you cannot plan for everything that happens, but we are prepared, and we think we're in a very, very good position to deal with any kind of anything that comes out of left field and that might surprise us economically.
One of the things that people throw into the discussion whenever we bring up the issue of roads here on the program, in 2019, the government signed a loan agreement with the CAF, Development Bank of Latin America, for $200 million to improve this country's road network through construction, rehabilitation, maintenance, and everything else. Did we receive that loan amount, and was it used? Because every time we bring it up, people say, well, I may not necessarily have seen the benefits of that $1 billion on the road infrastructure. Can you explain to us what happened there?
But generally, with these developments or loans, you don't just get the full amount and they tell you, you know, run off and play and let us know what happens. It's you do the work and you get paid in tranches. You get paid in portions. As the work is done, you gain access to another tranche and so on. So with the developmental banks. And that's why there's a lot of oversight where those funds are concerned. You have to show that the funds were used for the specific reason which they were borrowed. So if there wasn't much road work taking place, then the funds weren't used. Mm-hmm. You know, so the CAF has been extremely beneficial to Trinidad and Tobago. There's a less bureaucracy, we believe, in terms of dealing with the CAF, in terms of with the other multilaterals. A lot of the other Caribbean countries are now signing on to the CAF, because the CAF, the regional CAF office, is located in Trinidad and Tobago, which gives us access, and that has been extremely beneficial to us, and they've been very helpful.
Yeah. But let's get back to the discussion on the economy and all of those things. Yesterday,
sure,
we spoke to former Finance Minister Karen Nunes Teixeira, and she outlined to us that there are certain things we need to pay close, we need to pay close attention to. And she said with the shortfall in our income, which no one can deny, there are challenges that are going to confront the nation. And among those, she spoke of the continuing subsidy for fuels and the government capping it at $1 billion. And she said that that's something we probably need to look at, because the challenges brought on by not making the amount of money that we probably were expecting, there may be some further developments in that regards. Is that something that we have to pay close attention to?
Yes, well, we're always carefully looking at the fuel subsidy in Trinidad and Tobago because of the high cost associated with it. And in some years, we've paid up to $2 to $4 billion in fuel subsidy. And unfortunately, there's not much productive return from the fuel subsidy. It's also heavily bent towards persons who are in a higher income bracket. You know, an example that I've used in the past, if it costs me $50 to fill my tank, and the fuel subsidy, sorry, it costs me $100 to fill my tank, and the fuel subsidy is 50%, then the government would have paid $50 for you to fill your tank. But if my tank is $500, they would have paid $250 in subsidy for me to fill my tank. So it is not as beneficial or not as efficient in terms of alleviating poverty as you might think. It is a lot more efficient for us to use those funds and target them towards specific programs to improve, to help and assist the most vulnerable persons in Trinidad and Tobago. Mm. And that's when you discuss the removal of the subsidy. Yes, we want to ensure that persons in the lower income bracket can still access relatively cost-effective fuel. But we also want to ensure that persons who can afford it pay their fair share at the same time. And that's why the fuel subsidy is always a major discussion around every budget period.
Yeah, definitely. I guess we could understand why, because it's one of the things that has the most direct impact on the population, and the trickle-down effect, domino effect on prices and the cost of living and everything else. It's associated with the fuel subsidy.
Yes, and that's why the government has never touched the fuel subsidy on LPG, you know, because we have the lowest cost LPG in the entire region, and that is what a lot of low-income families use for cooking and so on in their homes. And we have never touched that. And for the most part, the fuel subsidy has been far more focused on premium fuels and not on, say, diesel, which is more of a business or industrial fuel. So without, you know, roiling the economy, we're also giving persons who are working in the transportation industry option. There's CNG available for such persons, the CNG kits, far cheaper. Diesel, the subsidy has not been dramatically removed on diesel at all, but it has been removed on premium fuel. And that's to ensure that the most vulnerable amongst us are still protected while being more cost efficient in the way that we target alleviating poverty in Trinidad and Tobago.
Now, I know we have a raging discussion amongst some sectors about CNG versus hybrid and all of those kinds of things.
Yes.
In 2017, yes, I took the decision, and I'm speaking from personal experience here, and this is not to endorse anyhow, just speaking fact. In 2017, I thought it wise to purchase a CNG vehicle. And I'll tell you, that's probably one of the best decisions I've ever made. And even today, when you go into the gas station, people who drive in gas vehicles, you pull up to fill your CNG, they stand up and they're watching. And some people are amazed that it takes you $9, $10 to fill up your tank. And they come across and they ask you all kinds of questions about, how long does it last and where it could go and whether your car have power and all these kinds of myths still swirling around. And for all the years that I've had my vehicle, I'll tell you, this CNG is probably one of the best things I ever buy. It is. Because
I've heard the ads on the radio, and I've wondered to myself why more people don't invest in a CNG kit. It is far cheaper, you know, and it's relatively safe. I mean, you haven't heard of any major incidents involving CNG.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, especially if you are in an industry, say you are a taxi driver, one of those heavy transport industries, why would you not give CNG an opportunity?
And I know that
it will dramatically save you money.
There are incentives for persons in taxis, at least who want to get it for a payment plan. But I am of the opinion, and I'm not here to make any kind of endorsement, as I said, but I believe that if there was some sort of structure that would allow people financing for the CNG kit, more people could take it. But let's be real, a $17,000 price tag is prohibitive to many people at this point in time.
Yes.
And to the people who may need it most than anything else, that's for sure. We need to take a couple messages. Our time moving to just about 16 minutes before 8. But when we get back, we know that our revenues are not where we expected them to be. But I'd want to get a sense from you as to, well, how much of a shortfall have we seen in these last 6 months, and how much is it going to impact on us moving forward? That and so much more. We continue our discussions on our mini-series here, right here on the Morning Rumble, Mid-Year Review. Our special guest here this morning, Minister in the Ministry of Finance, Brian Manning. Probably take a couple of your calls when we get back as well. Stay with us.
Is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
With us here this morning, our special guest, Minister in the Ministry of Finance, Brian Manning. We're discussing the economy mid-year review a little later on. I'll probably discuss some of the bricks. I'd ask him a question about our revenue shortfall. Let's take one or two quick calls before we continue. Hello, good morning.
Hi, morning. Morning, Minister Manning, my apologies. Minister Manning, I heard what you were saying about the mental issues after the coming out of the COVID, and you know it has an impact on the crime. That's what is impacted the crime situation away. But I find it very strange, and I don't really buy into it, because I can't understand why, you know, it's not affecting the entire population. It's just affecting certain areas and certain people in certain areas. So I really can't buy into that. I'm sorry, but you know, that's in the whole water, really. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for your call.
Yeah. I understand what the caller is saying, and I'm not saying that is the only factor that, of course, contributes to crime and criminal activity in Trinidad and Tobago and the region, but it is one of the factors, or one of the major factors that is influencing crime at this point in time.
Another quick call before we get back into our discussion. Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Satish Naparima here. Mr. Manning, I would like to ask...
Hi, good morning.
About what took place yesterday, I could ask you that, or just finance?
When you say what took place, were you talking about the conference?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm assuming. Ask the question, yeah, whether he chooses to answer, he will. We'll see.
Yeah, what I want to find out is, a meeting like this with CARICOM come to Trinidad, we host them. Do you think it was right not to have the opposition leader or a member of the opposition not addressing the CARICOM nation? And the audience was there.
All right, let me stop you there. I think, and Mr. Manning could respond now, but you see, these four, they're not a PNM UNC thing, you know. That's CARICOM. When you're at the CARICOM level, you deal with the office holders, prime minister, and so on. And while I take your point about the opposition leader, it's not the forum for the opposition, because it's the prime ministers or the various heads of government who make up the various positions within CARICOM. And while you go to Kamala, talk about everything that is possible, it's not necessarily the forum, it's not the protocol, if I understand it correctly. I don't know if Mr. Manning wants to speak about that, if you think that he needs to, but that's my understanding of it. It's not a forum just because it's Trinidad that, well, the opposition and everybody else will get a chance to talk. It doesn't work that way at forums like these. You care to add anything?
You're absolutely right, and the opposition leader does have a forum to voice her opinion, and she did so yesterday. It's all over the news today, and they have their opinions on what's going on, and the forum would do their job, and she would do hers.
Yeah. Let's get back into our discussion. Prior to the break, I had asked probably one of the questions that everybody wants an answer to, and they're looking forward to our finance minister saying to us about our revenue. We were expecting a shortfall, because things aren't where they were in the last financial year, globally, when it comes to energy prices and our production and everything else. But how much of a shortfall are we looking at?
Yes, well, I couldn't say specifically at this point in time. All will be revealed at the media review. And that's where we really take a look at what expenditure that we did, that we had spent during the time, and what our revenue picture looks like. You have to also remember, we're very fortunate to be in a good position that we have an HSF, which helps us to really smooth over those volatile periods in our economy, which was the whole point of the HSF in the first place. It's supposed to be a fund where during the good times, when your revenues are high, you place the excess in the fund, and then during the not so good times, you would use some of the funds from the HSF to make up for your financial shortfall. So in that situation, we are, you know, it could be that we are under budget in terms of revenues and still not really see a major effect in our economy because we were able to make up for that shortfall.
Are we going to see a major realignment of allocations?
At the mid-year review, I wouldn't say that. Of course, we would look at what we expect the future revenues to be and look at the projects that we believe will have the most impact and most beneficial to the people of Trinidad and Tobago. But that's a constant affair. It's not something that is only done at the mid-year review. It's something that we look at all the time and are constantly trying to decide which projects should move forward, which policies would have the most impact, which would be the best for the people of Trinidad and Tobago at this point in time.
Where are we focusing our energies when it comes to our revenue at this point in time? I know that we've had, there was a lot of expectation with the announcement by the U.S. that they were granting this two-year license for us to monetize the Dragon gas field. Since then, we've had discussions, our Minister of Energy going across to Venezuela. Unfortunately, we've seen recent developments where the Venezuelan energy minister was arrested and Nicolas Maduro saying every contract that he was ever involved in is going to be scrutinized now. That puts a real damper on our plans to monetize this thing before the two-year window is up.
The Minister of Energy has publicly stated that development should not affect our discussions with Venezuela. You know, it's not a mutually exclusive thing where only one thing can take place at a time. The investigation will take place, but business as usual in Venezuela. We'll continue working with the Venezuelan government and trying to come to a mutual agreement that would make both parties, all parties involved, satisfied.
Yeah.
In terms of revenues, yes, we are looking towards the Dragon Field, but also in terms of diversifying our economy, different diversification projects, also improving our taxation net to ensure that persons would pay their fair share, not have just one portion of our economy paying for everyone. And that's the problem with poor taxation policy, where there are loopholes. Persons are leaving the tax burden on a handful of persons who are being honest and paying their taxes on a regular basis, while others have been trying to circumvent the tax net. That, of course, places a heavy burden on those who aren't. So we're also trying to improve our tax net to ensure that everyone pays their fair share. And as the policies improve and people pay more of their fair share in terms of taxes, you can, over time, generally reduce the overall tax burden on individuals and corporations in Trinidad and Tobago. So that's something we're looking forward to.
But what does it mean, improving our taxation and the tax net? What exactly does that mean?
We're developing the TTRA, where we're bringing under its umbrella the various taxation or revenue collection services within the government.
Mm-hmm.
And we are ensuring, same thing as property taxes. We haven't collected property taxes in a long time. So that is also tax revenue, which can be put to local government for improving the services that we all require to even be able to enjoy our properties in the first place. And that is a major argument, is in that the property taxes is not an attempt to be draconian or try to inflict pain on the population, is ensure that there's a pool of funds that can be directed towards local government activities to ensure that you can enjoy the property that you live in the first place. If local government didn't spray for mosquitoes in some parts of this country, you couldn't enjoy your property, you couldn't live there. If they didn't improve roads, drainage, and all of the other services provided by your local government body, properties would be unlivable and unusable and therefore not have any value to begin with.
Mm.
And that's the major thing. We're trying to ensure that everyone is paying their fair share, and that should lighten the burden on all of us over time.
Yeah, we need to take a couple quick messages to take us up to the top of news. But when we get back in the 8 o'clock hour, I'll have you for a couple minutes there until probably 8:20. We need to discuss this thing about retirement age and some of what we're looking at, because it's a discussion we need to have. We have a population that's living longer. It's a discussion that other parts of the world are engaging. And we also need to discuss BRICS, this BRICS grouping, and the effect that it may or may not have on how we do business and how we survive. That and so much more on the other side of the 8 o'clock news with our special guest here this morning in our media review series. That, of course, a minister in the Ministry of Finance, Brian Manning. This is The Morning Rumble. Stay with us.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
4 minutes after 8, the final hour of our show here this morning. With us, probably until 8:20 or so, our special guest as we continue our media review series, Minister in the Ministry of Finance, Brian Manning. Take a couple of your calls. You can send your messages to 306-1065. We have a couple messages here. Let's see what we have. Somebody saying, good morning. I would like to ask Mr. Manning whether he would describe the crime situation as a national emergency. I have a couple of questions sent in here. I'll probably pose them to you quickly so we can get them out of the way. So that's
sure,
first
no
one.
Problem.
And the first one, crime situation, national emergency or not?
It is something that we have to take careful view of. It's, of course, I mean, any crime is too much, and it is something that we need to take a look at, because it's not just a local problem. As you heard from the various leaders throughout the region, crime has been a regional problem. In some cases, some people will say it's a global problem. Of course, persons who are more vulnerable would have been more affected by the COVID crisis. People are unemployed for 2 years. People are under tremendous mental stress and emotional strain for 2 years. Some of our children haven't recovered from the COVID crisis, COVID pandemic. You can see it in what's happening in our schools to some degree. Our children's immune systems, I've heard reports in various schools of there being a viral outbreaks almost every month where children have to stay home because their immune systems aren't used to being around other children for a long enough period. So they were primed, you know. So there's a whole lot of things that came out of the COVID crisis that we continue to deal with.
Yeah. There's another question. It's a pretty interesting one. Somebody's asking, well, we've been hearing for quite some time about the Trinidad and Tobago Revenue Authority. When is that actually going to come on stream? And there's a follow-up to it asking about the net. And how is this revenue authority going to cater to persons who have their own small businesses but don't necessarily fall within the regulations as we have them now? And the persons at doubles men, farmers, and all of these other people. Is the revenue authority going to start looking into these activities and taxing these people as well?
Yeah, what the Revenue Authority mainly does is brings all of the revenue collection agencies of the government under one umbrella so that, you know, it becomes a lot more transparent. The challenge we've been having is that it requires, the legislation, its original form, required a constitutional support from the opposition, and they refused to give us that. So it had to be changed in a form where it could be passed without that constitutional majority. And of course, it is a far-reaching, wide-ranging piece of legislation, and has been quite complex in implementing it in the first place. This has been maybe a decade since this was first initiated, and it's still continuing to be. One of the biggest parts is that the aspects of the revenue collection agency, mainly say customs, where there are actual police powers, and police powers are protected by the Constitution. And you couldn't just simply move those police powers from one organization to another. That's one of the major legislative challenges of dealing and implementing the TTRA.
You know,
so there are many moving parts, and that adds to the complexity of the implementation of the entire thing. And that's what we're dealing with.
We've had the discussion numerous times on the program, and we've been discussing the Revenue Authority since 2009. When it was it was introduced by, well, Karen Nunes Teixeira was the finance minister at the time, and Patrick Manning, your father, he was the prime minister. And we saw the convulsions that took place back then. We had the lunchtime protest. David Abdullah, where he get locked up every lunchtime and they let go him in the afternoon and all of that. We saw it. We did. Yes. And it.
I remember it. Absolutely. Yeah,
it featured prominently. I mean, not joking about it, but it was true. Every lunchtime, you had Watson Duke and them outside Parliament and Red House and everything else. It featured prominently in the 2010 general election. And 13 years later, we still discussing this thing about revenue authority. We haven't been able to put it in place.
Yes.
What guarantees do we have that amalgamizing all these other things and putting them under one grouping and changing the name and giving them more powers is going to bring us the results that we are told we're going to get? Because I believe whoever had to pay the tax should pay the tax, and if there's a mechanism to bring them into one umbrella. But we know in this country we change things. NHA became HDC and BWIA became Caribbean Airlines, and the list goes on and on. What guarantees can we get that we will get the results?
Well, we didn't invent the TTRA. The TTRA has been used in several other countries and has been quite effective. So it has been tried and tested, and that's why we believe that it would be effective here in Trinidad and Tobago. Of course, the proof is in the implementation. Once it has been brought to bear on the economy, we will see and assess exactly how effective it has been and make adjustments from there. But the TTRA has been effective in other places, has been proven to work, and it's something that we firmly believe will work here in Trinidad and Tobago in terms of developing a more fair tax collection system, which I think we all want.
Okay, let's take one or two quick calls before we get back into our discussion. Hello, good morning.
Good morning, Satish, and your guest. Good morning, man. We were talking a little bit about time and its effect on the economy. I know that there are a lot of studies that show that households where there is no father, you know, and this is where you're saying that the children tend to the trend towards criminal activity and deviant behavior. Are there any financial incentives being put by the government to incentivize keeping families together, you know, keeping couples together? Because to my mind, you know, it seems that all the assistance goes to these families where single mother, single this, single that, and there's no so the incentives go to the reverse of what the politicians are getting. I was just wondering if Mr. Manning
has that. Okay, thanks for your question, Mr. Manning.
Yes, I'd have to say that the caller is absolutely correct. And every study has shown that households where there's no father in the home, children are more vulnerable to more antisocial behaviors, whether it's school delinquency, whether it's going to prison, whether it's drug use, whether it's teenage pregnancy, all of these negative behaviors that do not benefit a society. Almost every study has shown that that is the case. It's very difficult, while saying that, to, I guess, legislate or enforce, have some laws in place to encourage more fathers to raise their children. It's difficult. That calls for a cultural shift and a change in thinking and a change in the way people operate. But it is something that I think the Ministry of Social Development has been working on and has a campaign. But of course, that is something that's going to take time for us as a country to see the benefits of. It's not something that a change in mentality doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah, there's just one more question sent in here I think we should deal with. They're asking about the gambling industry and what's going to happen to the gambling industry, because I don't want to say it's a convoluted discussion, but it has moved far away from where the initial goalpost was, which was bringing these institutions under the various regulations and getting them to pay their taxes and everything else. Now we have injected into the discussion the element of organized crime and all of those things. How are we going to treat with them moving forward?
Yes. But when the legislation has been passed in the parliament and various elements are still to be proclaimed, but the entire thing was to really ensure that there was some level of regulation in an industry that was previously totally unregulated, and an industry that, by our estimation, generates billions of dollars in revenues on an annual basis. And when I talk about having a more fair taxation system, the gambling industry was allowed for many years to go on without paying any major taxes because of their private membership club status. So that is something that we have changed to ensure that the government receives its fair share and can use those funds to really impact or to deliver goods and services to the people of Trinidad and Tobago. And also the legislation calls for these very gambling institutions to offer services to their own clients in terms of persons who may have addictions, persons who may not be able to control their habit. There must be a level of social assistance that is being funded and paid for by these institutions. They cannot just operate and have negative effects on the society and not have to pay or to do something about those negative effects.
Mm. Let's look now at one of the more controversial issues, not just here at home, but across the globe. We see fiery, violent protests in France. Canada is grappling with the issue as well. And other parts of the world, increasing the retirement age. Here at home, we're having that discussion. Where are we at this point in time with that?
Yes, this should not be a controversial issue. It is one, it's an issue of demographics. I know a lot of people have an emotional response to what should be essentially, what calls for a logical solution. All of these social security and pension funds around the world were essentially designed the same way. Okay? So you pay your contributions. They go into a general fund. This fund is invested in whatever, stocks, bonds, whatever, for return. So you use the contributions to the fund and the returns from the general fund to pay out benefits to persons who have retired. What has happened over time, and we've all seen it, is that people have been having less children. So because of it, the workforce also has been shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that there are less contributions to the fund. At the same time, retired folks have been living far longer, right? People are living into their 80s, 90s. We had a program in San Fernando East where I would go visit the home of someone who turned 100 years old. And we had to give up the program because almost every other week, I would have to go visit someone's home, you know, to say happy birthday. That's just how it is. I had an aunt who died the other day. She was 104. Okay? So that puts a lot of stress. So you have less contributions coming in. But the benefits, the demand for benefits, are getting larger and larger every year. So, of course, that is unsustainable. And at some point, the fund will go bust. The issue that we're seeing in places like France is that France has some of the most labor-friendly laws in the world, and everything is subsidized and paid for by the state. This is a state-funded pension. And if the French decide that they do not want to have an increase in pension age, or anyone else for that matter, you're going to come to a point where there will be no state-funded pension for anyone because the fund will go bust. It is inevitable. And it has to be changed. We already saw an increase in pension age in Barbados, I believe. I think it's 65. And in Jamaica right now, it's 67. In the UK, they completely abolished the retirement age. You retire when you're ready and you get the benefits for how long you have worked. So that's a change that is inevitable and something that we should be actually clamoring for, because without it, there will be no fund and no pension going forward. Future generation.
But do we have a timeline within which we are going to get this done, or are we just going to ride it out and see how it goes? Because the point that you're raising, it's a valid one, and that's the stability of the National Insurance Fund and how much it can it can sustain, because you have increased demand. Recently, some time ago, we had a story about 100,000 people dropping out of the National Insurance Scheme for whatever reason.
Yes.
And the impact that would have would be significant on a fund. So have we set a timeline as a nation that's saying that by 2025, we need to make a decision on this one way or the other, or are we, or we do not have a timeline?
It is going to happen. I couldn't tell you exactly when it's going to happen. The Minister of Finance will decide that in due course. But what I would tell the public to allay some fears is that the National Insurance Fund is the largest fund in the entire region. It's about $31 billion. So yes, there are stressors on the fund, but it's not going to collapse tomorrow. There's no risk of that whatsoever. So you can rest assured. We are just making sure that these changes are implemented in a timely manner to ensure that the fund will be there for a long, long time to come. But it's nowhere near collapse. It's not going to, you know, you're not going to wake up tomorrow and hear that the fund has gone bust. It's not possible. It is the single largest fund in all of CARICOM at about $31 billion, and it is very well managed.
The National Insurance falls directly under the Ministry of Finance?
Yes.
There was a story recently that said records for a number of years for, I think it's 100 or a couple of thousand clients went missing. What's being done about that? What can be done about that?
Well, with our digitization efforts, we have been finding, you know, various gaps in our information and data and so on. So what persons who may have been, you know, paying their contributions for a period of time, there would be proof with your employer and other places that we can verify whether a person was employed or not and whether contributions were being made. It does make things a bit more onerous, of course, and a bit more bureaucratic, but it can be and will be rectified.
But okay, now let me just put it in a practical perspective. Is NIS contacting these people and saying, hey, listen, we've identified a problem and we need you to come rectify it now, or are people going to, or is it a situation where we wait for these people to come in? Some of them may not come in for the next 10 years or 15 years and then realize, well, here, well, 5 years, am I thing missing or no? And it causes a set of problems. What's happening to address it?
I couldn't tell you exactly what NIS is doing in terms of reaching out to people or not, but I would imagine that they would at some point reach out to persons. If their names are there, but their data isn't, they would reach out and say, so-and-so is the issue. I don't believe that they would have a policy where they would sit back and, you know, wait for persons to retire and say, oh, we don't have the information. And that is something I can discuss with the NIB and their board, and we can ensure that people of Trinidad and Tobago are being fairly treated.
I think that's
couldn't say for certain exactly what it is they're doing about it at this point.
I can't tell you how to do your stuff, but I think that's information people would want. I mean, and it would help.
Yes.
Definitely. But there's another thing. As we're talking about NIS, and I've come across it on numerous occasions, if we are saying that there's a shortfall in the persons making contributions, and for whatever reason, less and less people are making contributions, but there is an entire category that is being prevented from making a contribution. That's self-employed people.
That is also part of one of the reforms of the fund itself. It's not just the increasing retirement age is part of a package of reforms that were needed to improve the fund and increase its longevity, and including daily paid workers. Also, the self-employed is a part of that package of reforms.
Yeah.
And that you will see very soon.
Yeah, because
we have meetings with the unions and we discuss daily paid workers, also the private sector. And everyone was on board. Some of the unions, you know, didn't think that their membership would approve of the increase in retirement age, and that's fine. But for the most part, I think most people in Trinidad and Tobago understand the benefits of what's being done and why it's being done.
Yeah, if we are to look in the direction of boosting the fund in terms of contributions, that grouping self-employed can go a long way in picking up the gap that has been created for whatever reason by others. We're almost out of time because the discussion is going so interesting. But I need to get from you, before we wrap up, an indicator. We are hearing internationally of this major development. The BRICS alliance with Brazil and China and all of these others coming together. And now they've identified a unified currency amongst themselves. Strange enough, you click on one of these things on social media and you always have a million of them popping up telling you all kinds of things. And the school of thought is that it is intended at all the trillions of US dollars being held all over the place going to be liquidated, and the US dollar is going to find itself no longer having the prominence that it once did. That can have financial reverberations across the world. What's our situation and how? Where do we stand on it, number one, and what are some of the possible impacts we can see?
Yeah, at this point in time, I think there's a lot of hype out there about this. What happened is that China and Brazil, and China is Brazil's number one trade partner, decided to begin trading in the yuan. Essentially, instead of having to convert the real or yuan to US dollars first and then into the currency of the other country, they decided to start trading directly with each other in the yuan. China has done the same thing previously with Pakistan. There's been a lot of discussions about the BRIC countries coming together to form a trading bloc. Now, the name BRICS was first coined by a Goldman Sachs report in 2001. And they were saying that these are the developing countries in the world that will eventually dominate the world economy. And of course, it stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Three of these countries are essentially commodity producers, while China is maybe the number one user of commodities worldwide. But for you to have a trading bloc that works, we have seen how difficult that has been. You look at the European Union, you look at Mercosur, you look at right here at CARICOM. It is a complex situation, but all of these trading blocks would require a unified currency to make trade simpler, easier, and cheaper across their borders. That is a major advantage that the American economy has over everyone else. Throughout the United States, all commerce and trade is underpinned by something called a UCC document. It's a Uniform Commercial Code. And all of their commercial laws stem from this unified code. And that makes trade between different states in the United States cheaper and easier. Everything that they do in terms of the economy is designed to produce improved GDP and to increase commerce. Now, for this to work, you are asking China, Russia, India, South Africa, and Brazil. These are five very different countries. To have a uniform platform and a unified currency to conduct trade. Now, you can understand how difficult and challenging that would be. The Chinese, of course, have made it quite clear that they intend to try to dominate the world economy and to take the United States' place as the top economy in the world. That is easier said than done. It's not impossible, but it's going to take a lot of hard work and coordination by the Chinese government and their economy. So I wouldn't lose sleep over it to say overnight that the U.S. dollar is somehow going to become useless. That is not going to happen anytime soon. And they've been discussing a unified trading platform between these BRICS countries for almost 20, 30 years now, and it hasn't really made any real progress. So it's something that can happen, but as we have seen in other trading blocks in other places, it can be quite difficult. So it's something to look to, but not worry about.
Yeah. As we wrap up our discussion, because we've gone way past the time that you allocated to us.
Yes,
this month. That's okay. But looking to the next 6 months of this financial year and looking to the future, there are people who are concerned about where we are. The Minister of Finance says the statistics say that we are in a good position when it comes to employment. There are others who don't necessarily think that we are. There are some who believe that the economy is doing well, that we are on the right path, and you would obviously have detractors. Just tell us, as a nation, looking for those who are concerned as such, what are some of the indicators we need to keep an eye on as we move forward?
Yes. I'd like to tell the people of Trinidad and Tobago that Trinidad and Tobago in the past 10 to 15 years has gone through maybe the most tumultuous time in our economic history. We went from the 2008 financial crisis, which was it had global impact. From 2014 to 2016, we saw the most precipitous decline in energy prices seen since World War II. And then in 2020, we had another global event, which was a pandemic. And even during those tumultuous times, there were no mass layoffs in Trinidad and Tobago. There was no persons getting paid late in the public service. None of those things happen. If you look at our CARICOM neighbors, you will see a different story. I remember I was employed in the IDB in the early 2000s. And the discussion then about the region was about increasing the moratoriums on various financial instruments. A moratorium is a delay in making payments. So it might start off, you might have an instrument, you might get a two-year moratorium before you have to start making payments. And then it went to a five-year moratorium. Recently, the IMF developed a financial instrument for this region that gives a 10-year moratorium on a 30-year instrument. And now, last week, I was in Washington, D.C., went to the IMF World Bank meetings, and our CARICOM neighbors are calling for debt forgiveness. Debt forgiveness says that they are unable to repay some of or much of the money that they had borrowed in previous years for various reasons. We live in a vulnerable region that can be hit by hurricanes, that can be vulnerable to major economic forces throughout the world and during all of these things, all of that, Trinidad and Tobago has remained a relatively stable economy. Yes, things are not perfect. Things are challenging in Trinidad and Tobago, but we are nowhere near a basket case like, say, Haiti or other countries within the region that are now saying that they're going to have a difficult time climbing their way out of the economic situation because they are unable to repay their debts. So we are doing quite well. Is there room for improvement? Of course, there always is. And this government will be focusing on our diversification projects, which will create more sustainable jobs and revenues going forward, while at the same time protecting the most vulnerable persons within our country. That has been our goal and our objective, and it is the path that we are going to follow going forward.
And that's probably the best way for us to end our interview here this morning. It's been pretty interesting. We covered a lot of topics in the short space of time. We did. We really did. And I thank you so much for being with us.
It's your fault for giving me a platform to talk so much.
You know, they say hand a politician a mic and you know what goes on after that. Well, we thank you for being with us here this morning. We are looking as a nation towards the economy. A robust economy helps every single one of us. As I said, there are some who believe we're doing it right, others who believe we're doing it wrong. We move forward hoping for the best with what we have. And we anxiously await the Minister of Finance telling us when the media review is going to be so that we can get from him exactly what's going on. And I'm sure that probably after that presentation, we would want to speak to you again to speak about some of what the minister would have put in place at the media review. Thank you for being with us once again this morning.
Not a problem. Always happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
And that, of course, ladies and gentlemen, our special guest this morning, Minister in the Ministry of Finance, Brian Manning.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.